This is Audible.
Sounds True presents The Inner Art of Meditation, an introduction to Vipassana, or Buddhist Insight Meditation, with Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield is one of the senior teachers of insight meditation in America. He is an ordained Buddhist monk, has trained in Thailand, Burma, and India, and has taught meditation worldwide since 1974. Jack Kornfield was educated at Dartmouth, worked in public health with the Peace Corps in Asia, and later completed a PhD in clinical psychology. Jack is a husband, father, psychotherapist, and a founding teacher of the Insight Meditation Society and the Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California. For many years, his work has been focused on bringing alive the great Eastern spiritual teachings in an integrated, accessible way for Western students. His books include Seeking a Heart of Wisdom, A Still Forest Pool, Stories of the Spirit, and his new book, A Path with Heart, Through the Perils and Promises of Spiritual Life. The Inner Art of Meditation documents a series of 5 experiential classes recorded live in Marin County, California. As an introduction to this series, we will begin The Inner Art of Meditation with excerpts from an introductory lecture by Jack Kornfield called Why Meditate? And now, The Inner Art of Meditation with Jack Kornfield.
I'd like to speak a little bit about the heart of the practice, meditation, by posing some questions, which may or may not be ones that you have. They're at least ones that I think I have an answer to, and then responding to them. What's the essence of meditation practice? Shortly after the Buddha was enlightened, there's a story that he was walking down the road, met some people who saw him, and he was in a very happy state. He was supposed to have been quite a handsome prince before his going off to be a monk. So here's this handsome prince, now wearing golden robes and recently enlightened and obviously quite pleased. I was going to say pleased with himself. I don't know about that. But at least very happy. And very special from all accounts. So they saw him and they said, wow, you seem very special. What are you? Are you some kind of an angel or a deva? He seemed unhuman in some way. No. Well, are you some kind of a god then? No. Well, are you some kind of a wizard or magician? No, he replied. Well, are you a man? No, he said. Then what are you? And he answered, I am awake. And in those 3 words, I am awake, gave the whole teachings of what Buddhism contains. To be a Buddha is one who has awakened. Awakened to the nature of life and death and the world in which we live, awakened the body and mind. And so the practice of meditation from the Buddhist or other traditions is not to become a meditator or a spiritual person or a Buddhist or join something, but it's rather to understand this capacity we have as humans to awaken. Now, what is that which we can awaken to? What is the Dharma which we can awaken to? Dharma is a Sanskrit and Pali word that refers to that which is universal, to the teachings and to the laws of the universe, teachings which describe it. And the Dharma, or the laws, the way things work, are always here to be discovered. They're quite immediate. So there's a story many of you old meditators who come to these things will have heard before, of a pious man who very much believed in God. And one day, at the place where he dwelled, it started to rain heavily, and it rained, and a big flood came. And he went from his first floor to the second floor of his house, and the water rose until he was on the roof. Someone rode by and said, "Get in, my friend, I'll save you, the water's rising." He said, "No, I believe in God, I really have faith, I believe." So he sent the rowboat away. It rained more and the water got all the way up to his neck, and another boat came by picking up people. "Get in, my friend, I'll save you." "No, thank you, I have trust, I've lived my whole life, I believe in God, no need." The rowboat goes away, it gets up to his nose, just barely can breathe, and a helicopter comes over and lowers down a rope. "Come up, my friend, save you." "No, thank you, I believe, I have faith, I trust." So the helicopter goes away, it rains some more, and he drowns. He goes to heaven after that, and after not very long there, he gets an interview with God, and it's his turn. So he goes in, you know, and he sits down and pays his respects and whatever, and then he says, "You know, I just don't understand it. Here I was, your faithful servant. I was so trusting and prayed and so believing, and I just don't understand what happened to me." And he sort of recounts all his circumstances. "Where were you when I needed you?" And God looks and kind of scratches his head and says, "I don't understand it either. I sent you two rowboats and a helicopter." And we wait somehow for God to come as some big flash or our spiritual awakening to be some wonderful otherworldly experience. What the Dharma is and what we can awaken to is the truth that's here when we leave our fantasies and our memories and things behind and come into the present. When we do that and we start to pay attention, we start to see some of the characteristics of the Dharma or the life in which we live. One characteristic is impermanence. "Thus shall you think of this fleeting world," it says in one Buddhist sutra. "A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, an echo, a rainbow, a phantom, and a dream." That as you look, the more closely you observe, the more you realize that everything you look at is in change. Seeing changes, hearing changes, smelling, tasting, physical sensations are changing. All the experience in the body and mind, all the experience of the senses. It seems solid. That's the illusion of santati. It's like a movie. And when you watch the screen and get caught in the story, it seems like it's very real. But then you turn your attention to the projector or slow it down or focus your awareness very carefully. It's even possible to do. And you start to see that it's one frame after another, one appearing in the next, dissolving the next arising. And it's so for our life that it's really a process of change. Because that's so, because things don't last, unless you have something that lasts in your life, please raise your hand if you do. Has anyone gotten any mental states to last very long of any kind? Someone once raised their hand and said, "Yes, ignorance. It's lasted my whole life." But basically it's change. You sit down here and in one day, you don't even have to be a very adept meditator to get the point that it moves all the time, that it changes. And because things don't last, if we're attached to them being a certain way, what happens? This is one of the laws. What happens? We suffer. We get disappointed. Not because you should. You can be attached as much as you like. But even though you're attached, does it stop it from changing? You have a nice mental state and you try and hold on to it. Does it last anyway? So you start to see the laws of things, that things are impermanent, that attachment doesn't work. that there must be some other way. There is actually what Alan Watts called the wisdom of insecurity, the ability to flow with things, to see them as changing process. You also see not only are they impermanent and ungraspable, that there's suffering if we're attached to them, and that there's pain as well as pleasure in this world. It's part of what we were born into. If you decide to get off on this planet and get one of these things with 10 little things on the end here and 10 little things on the end there and stuff that grows for a while, and that you put old dead plants and animals in and mush them up in order to get it to kind of move around. If you choose one of these things, which you have, it's too late already, what is the nature of it? It grows up, it grows old, it dies, it gets sick sometimes. Sometimes it feels good and sometimes it hurts. There's pleasure and pain in it. Anybody have one that doesn't hurt sometimes? Okay. If you want that, you gotta go to another planet, because it's not the way things are here. So you sit and you see, I'm just gonna be with my body and mind. I'm not doing anything, no big deal. And what do you find? You find sometimes it's pleasant, and sometimes it's painful, sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's restless. And you begin to relate to what Zorba called the whole catastrophe, all of it, instead of fearing the painful things and running away all the time and grasping after pleasant things, hoping that somehow by holding them they'll last, seeing that they don't. My teacher Ajahn Chah used to wander around the monastery at times and go up to people and just say, are you suffering much today? And depending what you'd answer, if you say yes, he said, oh, must be quite attached, and kind of giggle about it and go along. There wasn't much more to say. Okay. You see that you don't own it because it changes by itself, that you rent this house. You get it for a little while and you can honor it and feed it and walk it and jog it if you want. But it's not yours to possess. And you see, in fact, that none of these things are possessable, because the nature of life is non-possession. You're an accountant in the firm. You get to count it for a while, and that's all. So we sit to awaken, and we awaken by coming into our bodies and our senses and starting to see the laws which govern life so we can come into a wiser relationship with it. What does this mean for our lives? Well, this kind of teaching really teaches a way of wholeness and awareness, of bringing our body and mind together and our heart and our action, being conscious with our speech, conscious with our eating, conscious with walking, making it a part of what allows us to grow and live. And to do this means accepting the fact of impermanence and of some pain and suffering, and of the fact that we don't control it very much. I mean, you control some of it, but not very much, and in a really limited way. If you can't accept those things, then you will probably want to stay in your fantasy, because they are what you would encounter when you come here. Now, some people might ask, doesn't meditation fragment us away from the world? You say that it makes us more present. And it can, if we become attached to solitude, if we see spiritual practice, we sit and try and get quiet and block everything out, close your eyes and ears and nose, or go into a cave. And it's not to say you shouldn't go and take a vacation in Yosemite or have periodic retreats. But fundamentally, for spiritual practice to be alive in our life, it has to be that we can use it in the supermarket while we drive, when we're walking, when we're dealing with our family, to make all of it a part of it and not to escape. Someone might ask in the same vein as, doesn't meditation fragment us from the world? I say it can if one tries to escape, but what we're training here is an awareness that can be used throughout our day. Well, what about social responsibility? We're on the brink of nuclear war. There's exploitation and injustice in every country. There are 40 wars going on right now in Iraq and Iran and El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Jordan and Israel and Lebanon and Cambodia still and Laos and I don't know, Namibia and Angola and God knows where else, all these places. And it's not just a story. It's painful for millions of people, as is starvation, as is 50,000 nuclear warheads, which could literally destroy most of the human beings and many or most of the major animals that live on the planet in a painful way, easily, quickly. Now, one must listen to one's heart in this. It's interesting. You can make a compelling case for different sides. On one side, you can listen to Gandhi, who says, to come face to face with the universal, all-pervading truth, one must be able to love the meanest creatures as oneself. To do this, one cannot stay out of any field of life. Those who say religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion really means. And from that point of view, you see that what's necessary is not to sit, but to act. There is starvation. Nuclear war is imminent if we don't do something. There is compelling need, even in this very rich and affluent society of people who are suffering in many ways. And what are we doing sitting around? It's quite convincing. There's another side which is equally convincing. And that is, what is the cause of that starvation and all those wars and that suffering? What do you think is the source of it? There's enough oil. There's enough food. There's enough resources on this planet. The cause of it is greed. And the cause of it is prejudice and hatred. We hate people who different religion, different skin color, different customs. We like our country, our family, our religion, our type. And so there's hoarding and there's grasping and greed and hatred and ignorance. And we've tried through revolution for many centuries. It's helped in some ways, but in others it just keeps going around because we haven't touched the root of the problem. The root of the problem is for someone to discover what it means to not be caught up by anger, what it means to be free from that fear or that prejudice which arises in human hearts and minds, what it means to be unafraid of that which is painful as well as that which is pleasant, to be open, to have the heart open to all of what the world presents. So we don't need more oil and food as much as we need somebody who understands how not to get caught in anger and fear and prejudice. And that somebody is you. So instead of it being a luxury to meditate, from another point of view, it's a responsibility for anyone who can to figure out in their own being, in their own life, what it means not to be caught by these forces, to learn some new way, and then bring that to bear on the economic and social and political kinds of suffering as well in the world. It's a letter of mine that's a favorite, and I've read it many retreats. It's from a Nobel Prize winner named George Wald, who's a biologist at Harvard. He wrote it in response to an argument about the starting of a Nobel laureate's sperm bank. Some irate feminists wrote into the paper saying, sperm bank, they should have an egg bank. Why just sperm? He says, you're right, Pauline. It takes an egg as well as a sperm to start a Nobel laureate. Every one of them has had a mother as well as a father. And say all you want of fathers, their contribution to conception is really rather small. Nobel laureates aside, he said, there isn't much technically in the way of starting an egg bank. There are some problems, but nothing so hard as involve the other kinds of breeder reactors. But think of a man so vain as to insist on getting a superior egg from an egg bank. Then he has to fertilize it. And when it's fertilized, where does he go with it? To his wife? Here, dear, you can hear him saying, I just got this superior egg from an egg bank and just fertilized it myself. Will you take care of it? I've got eggs of my own to worry about, she replies. You know what you can do with your superior egg. Go rent a womb, and while you're at it, you better rent a room, too. You see, it just won't work, he says. For the truth is that what one really needs is not Nobel laureates, but love. How do you think one gets to be a Nobel laureate? Wanting love, that's how. Wanting it so bad one works all the time and ends up a Nobel laureate. It's a consolation prize. What matters is love. Forget sperm banks and egg banks. Banks and love are incompatible. If you don't know that, you don't know bankers. So just practice loving. Love a Russian. You'd be surprised how easy it is and how it will brighten up your morning. Love whales, Iranians, Vietnamese, not just here but everywhere. When you've gotten really good, you can even try loving some of our politicians. So this is the other voice. It's the voice that says, in addition to the compelling social problems of our time, he said this amazing thing. Even the Nobel Prize is a consolation prize, because what human beings most want is to be honored, to be loved, to be recognized. And what the world most compellingly needs is someone who understands how not to get caught in these ancient human patterns of prejudice and fear and anger. Doesn't meditation make people withdraw from the world? Anyway, one has seen that for sure. There's a fine teaching in the Buddhist tradition of called the near enemies. The near enemy of love is attachment. It masquerades like love, it feels like it, but it's separate. It says, I love you, but really I'm attached to you and I need you out there to make me whole, rather than just the sense of love is honoring and seeing our connection. The near enemy to compassion is pity. Oh, that poor person, they're suffering. I don't suffer. Not me, certainly. But they all do, and this sort of separates them again. The near enemy to equanimity or balance of mind is indifference. It masquerades as equanimity. Feels like, well, everything's fine, basically because I don't care about anybody. In not caring, we can find some peace. Real equanimity is when the heart begins to open and we find a capacity to experience all that the world presents with balance, with love, with openness. That it's not a running away from the world at all. It's really a sitting down right in the middle of it and paying attention to that which is pleasant and that which is painful, that which makes a lot of noise and that which is silent. And beginning to listen to our relationship to it, to observe it, to learn from it, and learn a wise way of relating. So then what is the heart of this inner way of practice? The heart of it is mindfulness, listening, attention, attention to our bodies, to all the various energies, to the voices, paying attention when we eat. Which voice do you listen to when you stop a meal? No, is it the belly which maybe speaks first and says, oh, had enough, comfortable, nice and full. And then the tongue chimes in, gee, but that fruit was so good, let's have a little more. And the eyes say, yeah, and there's more of that other stuff too that we haven't finished yet. And you hear all these different voices. To live in the feelings, to be aware of both emotions, to be aware of the pleasant and neutral and unpleasant aspect of our experience. And learn that we don't have to resist that which is painful and grasp that which is pleasant all the time. That's perhaps our conditioning, but in fact, it doesn't lead to peace. It doesn't lead to happiness. Because things change anyway. Even if you're attached to them, they change. It's an open-hearted and non-judging awareness which comes into the body and into the feelings, and then observes the mind as well and its laws, the laws of karma, the laws of impermanence, and begins to see how to relate to it all out of compassion or kindness and wisdom, which means seeing how it's really operating. Sometimes it gets very painful when you sit. Sometimes it's pleasant and you have bliss and light, then you get attached. Sometimes it gets painful and then you want to avoid it. Thomas Merton said at one point, true prayer and love are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and the heart has turned to stone. And sometimes It's in the very greatest difficulties in our sitting or in our life that our heart opens the most, or that we finally get the fact that we can't get attached to things and hold on to them. That they don't go the way we think, but the way that they go. And so wisdom begins to arise. How then to work with the basic difficulties which arise in meditation? What to do when there's physical pain? As best you can, sit and note pain, pain. Pay attention. See if you can notice how it changes. Sit comfortably. Don't make pain for yourself. There's plenty in this life without it. Start to pay attention to all of what makes up our reality. And that develops what is called in spiritual disciplines a heart of greatness. If you open the door to the outside, what do you get when you open it? You get whatever's out there. You get the weather for that day. And if you keep the door open, you get the weather changes. If you open your mind and your body and your heart, what do you get? You get everything. You get what's painful and what's pleasant. And there is a way to come to a new relationship of it. So in working with difficulties, desire, anger, restlessness, doubt, fear, these are the traditional list of hindrances which arise in meditation. How can one work with them? How can one make one's spiritual practice so that these become workable? There's a story in the community of George Gurdjieff of this obnoxious and very difficult man who finally left the community. He was having such a hard time, and Gurdjieff paid him to come back, and everyone was upset, because they all had to pay a lot to live there, and here's Gurdjieff paying this old creepy guy who gets annoyed at everybody and is dirty. And they asked him why he did that, and he said, this man is like yeast for bread. Now, without him, you wouldn't really learn the meaning of patience or compassion or loving kindness. You wouldn't learn that about yourself. So that when these states of mind arise, restlessness or desire or fear, wanting, if only it were somehow different than it is, or judgment, I don't like this, or worry or agitation, what to do with them? Sit in the very middle of them and study them. Note how they feel in the body. There's desire. Desire runs much of our world. You watch TV, that's all they sell is desire. Pay attention and see what it's like. How do you feel it in the body? What is it like in the mind? Give a clear and careful, mindful attention to it without getting caught, not suppressing it or trying to make it go away, and not getting involved, just noting desire, wanting, until you come to see its nature and you come to some balance where you're not so caught up in it or afraid of it. The same for anger. Most of us are either afraid of it and stuff it down, or we act it out. See if when judgment or anger arises, if you can just sit and note angry, furious, judging, whatever it is, and feel it. Just heat, movement, temperature, energy in the body, certain contraction, different qualities of mind. See if it's possible to experience that energy and learn from it. See how it changes, what it does to you, what its flavor, what the quality of it is, its effect on you. And then maybe you can learn not to be quite so caught in it. Doesn't mean it won't still come. Heaven knows. But that your relationship to it can be a wiser one. Do it again and again. With fear, with all the kinds of mental states that come up, especially the difficult ones, until you can sit and allow them to come and go like cows or sheep in the meadows. Now what if they're very strong? What if they're too difficult? They're really, really hard. What should you do? Say rest. You're so restless, you just can't stand it. What to do? Die. Okay? Be the first yogi to ever die of restlessness. Just say, fine, take me. Surrender to it and let it kill you. And what you discover if you do that is that, in a way, you die. What dies is your resistance to it. And that you just carry on. And you discover this powerful capacity we have, if you work with it, to open to all of our experience and find some balance in it. Now, if you're more advanced, if you've done practice for a while, you may also wish to work with this capacity one has of going into the very middle of something. There's desire or anger or fear or whatever it is, not just to feel it, but see if you can find the very center of it and discover what's there, or maybe go through the center in some way. Now, what about all the different kinds of meditation? Here one's learning Vipassana. How about Tibetan meditation or Zen or TM or so forth? There are a lot of good ways to practice. You know, there are these two students of a master who are arguing. One says, it's really good to sit very still and not move and just work with whatever pain comes. And the other one says, no, no, that's macho. You want to relax and be gentle and just be aware, but you don't make a lot of effort in it. And they're arguing, and they can't seem to get any answer, and they go to the master. And one says, you really got to make effort to bring your mind back and to stay very present and not to move. And that way you get through all this stuff. You learn how to be still in the middle of anything. And the master says, you're right. And the other one says, but wait a second. Don't you want to learn to be loving and gentle, to move if you really need to, and just to find a balance with it all, to be soft and not to struggle against it, simply to open? And the master says, you're right. And the third student who's sitting there says, but they can't both be right. The master said, and you're right too. Okay? There are a lot of good ways of meditation. Many good ones. There are some that are better than others in the sense that some are only have a limited purpose, but there are many major schools of meditation which are wonderful. If they develop awareness or mindfulness of the body or the mind and the heart, our sense experience, and the laws where you observe how the world is working, they can bring you to liberation. They can bring you to freedom. Any kind of meditation that does that. So it doesn't really matter which kind you've chosen. If you're doing Vipassana practice, wonderful. If what's accessible or interesting to you is Zen, fine. What's important is that you pick one and you stay with it and you do it. It takes discipline. If you want to learn to play piano, it takes more than just a day once in a while and a few minutes here and there. If you're lucky, after a year, you'll be able to play Happy Birthday to You. If you really want to learn something in a full way, tennis, piano, not to speak of training the mind and opening the heart, it takes perseverance and patience and a systematic training. Pick a practice. Use it, work with it every day, work with a teacher if you can, or in circumstances where you sit with other people. And in doing it over and over again, it starts to develop your capacity to open. It starts to train one to be more in the present moment. It starts to develop this sense of patience. It brings a kind of compassion when you sit and you really feel what's in there. Now, what to do if you actually attain something in meditation? People ask that sometimes. You should be so lucky is the first answer. But the second one, and the most important one, I remember when I went to my teacher Ajahn Chah after many adventures in meditating in other monasteries and different kinds of practice and experiences, and recounted them all to him, feeling kind of pleased with what I'd learned and how I'd open. And he just looked at me and he said, well, do you still have any greed? I said, yeah. He said, still got fear and anger? I said, yeah. Still got delusion? I said, uh-huh. He said, fine, continue. That was all he said, just continue. And so what you see is that meditation is not so much to attain some state of mind. They don't stay. You can't get them to stay. But to come to each moment with awareness, with a greater sense of openness of heart, and with a clear seeing. What can one learn of most value in all of this? Well, when people die, they tend to ask of themselves only a few questions. Commonly. Maybe just one or two. One might be, did I learn to live well, freely, honestly, authentically? And maybe even more fundamentally than that, did I love well? And all the other things one does, they have a certain measure of importance. But when it really comes down to it, have I loved well? When somebody says, okay, death comes to your left shoulder and taps you and says, this is your last dance, you get a few more thoughts and it's all over. What is your reflection to be? What do you care about? And what did you care about? And what meditation can open for us as a possibility in our sitting and even in the difficulties is this possibility of learning to be freer in the ups and downs and changes of life, in its pleasures and pains, and learning somehow to open and love, to be unafraid to express that love and to feel it in a full way. One of the most beautiful images for meditation which I've seen was a poster which showed this guru, Swami Satchitananda, wearing a little orange loincloth, his long flowing beard, a very handsome kind of Indian guru figure, who is also a fine teacher. And it showed him, he teaches yoga and meditation, many things, it showed him in the yoga posture standing on one leg like this, it's very graceful, only he was balanced on a surfboard on a big wave. It was very impressive. Okay? And underneath it said, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. Meditate with Swami Satchitananda or something like that. It captured the spirit of meditation practice and the teachings of how to manifest it or bring it into a world that is full of senses, of sights and sounds and change. So the reason we go through all this trouble and do this strange looking thing, to sort of sum up and finish this talk, is somehow to live more fully, to see the people that we live with, to see the trees, to be present when you go for a walk in the park and not be thinking about the bills that you need to pay and what happened yesterday, to live more fully here, to be able to love in a greater way by opening in ourselves to all the corners of our mind, to that which is difficult and that which is easy. And perhaps because it's our deepest desire to discover our true nature, to come to some sense of our oneness with life, or to understand who we are, or what all this strange thing that we got born into is about. Basically, it's the only game in town, if you look at it. Everything else is kind of transitory. And this is to pay attention and discover what the whole process of life and death are about. In order to do it, one needs to cultivate or practice mindfulness or awareness, to have it built on or foster some sense of inner stillness so that we can see and listen to all these things. And it requires courage. It's not such an easy thing. Only as a warrior, says Don Juan, a spiritual warrior, can one withstand the path of knowledge. A spiritual warrior cannot complain or regret anything. Their life is an endless challenge, and challenges cannot possibly be good or bad. The basic difference between an ordinary person and a warrior is that a warrior takes everything as a challenge, while an ordinary person takes everything as a blessing or a curse. And so it's a spirit of taking what comes to us and really working with it. That's a little bit heavy-handed in a way, even though I like it. And sometimes you take it as a challenge, and sometimes you do take it as a blessing or a curse, or you worry about it or complain. You can complain mindfully then, if that's what you want to do. Okay? You can learn from that as well as anything else. But the spirit of it is really one of opening, of discovery, of seeing, to sit, to walk, and to train yourself to bring the attention back, concentrate, mindful, balanced, to observe the breath, the body, the feelings, the mind, and all of the movement of what we got ourselves into, and see how one can relate to it at times in ways that cause pain, how one can learn to relate to it with wisdom, with loving kindness, with a greater sense of understanding and compassion. It's really not all that complicated. It's difficult to do sometimes, but it's not all that complicated. Someone once asked Aldous Huxley, as he was dying, if he could say what he'd learned in all of his experience with many spiritual teachers and gurus and much of his own spiritual life. And he said, it's embarrassing to tell you this, but it seems to come down mostly to just learning to be kinder. To be kind, though, means that you have to be here. You have to be present for what's actually in one's experience. So that's a lot of words. I hope it gives you some sense of the purpose of our practice.
This concludes excerpts from a lecture, Why Meditate, with Jack Kornfield. Our program now continues with the first class on the inner art of meditation. To get the maximum value from these recordings, you are encouraged to listen when you are in a position to participate along with the meditation exercises. And now, the first class in our series with Jack Kornfield.
My background, just to give you a very brief taste, is that I trained as a Buddhist monk in monasteries of Thailand, Laos, India, Sri Lanka, for a number of years, initially for 6 years, and then back and forth over a period of a dozen years in different monasteries. And I have been teaching meditation retreats, insight meditation retreats, around the country with several colleagues for the past 15 years. We started a large center in New England, the Insight Meditation Society, and are in the process of establishing a center here in Marin County at Spirit Rock, which is near Woodacre, San Geronimo Valley. After being a monk, I also then returned back and did a PhD in clinical psychology, in part to figure out what happened to me while I was a monk, for other reasons. I'm married and have a daughter who's 4 and a half, who gave me the flu, and who I love very much, and is a great part of my practice in every respect. I'll tell you a story, maybe, to start. It seems that there was a woman who decided one time to go to Tibet. So she went to her travel agent in New York, and she said, please get me a ticket for Tibet. Older woman, he said, Tibet? It's really a difficult, long trip. Why don't you just, you know, go to Miami like you're used to? And she said, no, I must go and see the guru. So he gets the ticket. She travels all the way to India, goes through customs at the airport in India, already quite arduous if you've never done it. Travels by train across India, gets to the Nepali border. They say, where are you going? She says, I must go see the guru. But you can only say 3 words to him. Doesn't matter, I've got to see him. Goes by jeep across Nepal and partway across Tibet. Long journey, many days, carrying her bags and bundles. Finally, they come to this huge mountain with a monastery on top, and she gets in line with all the pilgrims. And they say, what are you doing here from the West? She said, I must see the guru. So she waits in line 3 days and finally gets to the door. And there's a guard standing there. And he says, now remember, only 3 words. She says, I know, I know. So she goes in and sits down in front of him. And there he is wearing maroon robes and a wispy beard, and she looks him in the eye, and she says, Sheldon, come home. Now, I start with that story because what interests me in this class, and what has interested me for the past 15 or 20 years, is looking for a way to take the training and teachings that are offered in the very best Buddhist monasteries. And the heart of the Buddha's understanding and the gifts of those trainings, and make them really relevant to Western society. So that Vipassana practice, the word in Sanskrit means to see clearly, is a meditation practice that we'll share here that has nothing to do with your becoming a Buddhist or having anything to do with ceremonies or rituals or bowing or whatever. It's the heart of the Buddha's awakening, and it's found in Zen and in Tibetan practice, and the presentation we'll have here comes from the southern Buddhist school of India and Thailand and so forth. What's important to me is not conveying Buddhism to you in any way, but rather making a presentation or allowing you to understand how to actually work with meditation and benefit by it in some way in your life. There are two basic categories of meditation, two basic classes of meditation. The first class, and there are hundreds of kinds within it, are the meditations that focus on one single object. It can be a light, a candle flame, a feeling in the body, a mantra or a sacred word that you say over and over again. It can be an image that you hold. And in this whole category of meditation, you hold that particular object or say those words over and over and over again until they block out, basically, every thought and plan and memory and worry. And your mind becomes concentrated. And to be concentrated in that way is wonderful. It's very peaceful. You're not worrying, you're not planning, and the mind, when it becomes concentrated, becomes filled with a sense of well-being and light. So there are many ways to do that. The difficulty or drawback with those approaches to meditation, and Buddhism has some of those kinds in it as well, is that after you concentrate on your image or your light or you say your words to yourself and get concentrated, when you go back to drive on 101 or go to Safeway or Lucky or wherever you shop, Living Foods, you know, if you spend more, whatever it is, your meditation doesn't help you much. It's only good when you're visualizing the candle or when you're seeing a particular image. It made you peaceful, but then it's not so applicable in the rest of your life. The second class of meditation, and Vipassana falls in that, are the meditations that pay attention to the process of our experience. Rather than a light or a special word or a particular object, these meditations take the actual experience of life and develop a meditative understanding or relationship to it. So what we'll do in this class over 5 weeks in a row is a study or a practice of what's called the foundations of awareness or the four foundations of mindfulness. We'll work this first week with the breath, and then next week we'll expand the meditation to include all the energies of the body, working with pain and pleasure and itching and restlessness and all the different physical aspects, healing. Then the third week we'll begin to work with the heart, and how to meditate with the emotions and moods that move through us in our life, how to work with them from a meditative point of view. And then we'll work on, in the fourth week, with the mind directly, with the thoughts and images and plans and fears, and show how those can be part of meditation. And finally, we'll work with applying these in daily practice. Actually, all during the 4 or 5 weeks, there will be suggestions of making or establishing a daily practice. Now, the place that we're going to begin this meditation, and that really all genuine spiritual practice begins, is coming into the body, starting with relating to ourself, our breath, our own physical body, in a mindful or conscious or awakeful way. Have you all heard of out-of-the-body experiences? What we're going to do here, what we're interested in, is something far more difficult. It's called an in-the-body experience. There's a line in James Joyce, I think from Ulysses, where he says at some point, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. And so the first step in meditation, the first step in some understanding or awakening, is simply to come back to the reality of the present, not to our fantasies or our hopes or our expectations or our worries or any of those things, but to become rooted in an awareness in the present moment. The word Buddha, the name Buddha, means to be awake, awakened. And so the practice that we're going to do is an awakening. That is to become more aware of ourselves in our body, of breath, of the heart and feelings and how we relate to them, of the mind, of our likes and dislikes, and of a place of stillness or centeredness underneath all of that. It's also important to understand that the meditation, as we do it, the skill of becoming more mindful and more present or more awake, is not just for sitting cross-legged on a cushion or on a chair, but to concentrate or pay attention helps in computer programming, tennis playing, race car driving, love making, or walking by the ocean and really listening to the sounds. It's really the art of arts. It's the central art of the heart and mind to learn to be really present. Now, the first thing that's necessary, again, in any spiritual practice, is to come back here to this moment. There's a sign from a casino in Las Vegas that now rests in the therapy room of a friend of mine, and it says on it, "You must be present to win." And it's true in Las Vegas, and it's true in therapy, and it's the fundamental rule in spiritual practice. So that's really the starting place. I guess one more thing to say before we start the initial practice. That is that we're going to start very simply. Again, you may have read various spiritual books or heard or even experienced things that are exciting in spiritual life. But the ground out of which even the most interesting or exciting experiences come has to be a presentness, a centeredness, a wakefulness that is steady underneath all of that. "For me, the world is incredible," says Don Juan, speaking to Carlos Castaneda, "because it is stupendous, awesome, mysterious, unfathomable. My interest has been to convince you that you must assume responsibility for being here in this marvelous world, in this marvelous time. I've wanted to convince you that you must learn to make every act count, since you're only going to be here for a short while. In fact, too short for witnessing all the marvels of it." So the first step, again, is just to get to be here in our senses, in our body. All right, let's begin the first sitting. If you'd like, stand up and stretch just in your place for a minute. You've been sitting for half an hour now, some of you. Take a short stretch and then sit back down after that. Find a way to sit for this first step that is comfortable for you, in a chair or on a cushion. The rules that you might keep in mind for physical sitting is first that you sit in a way that is stable, whether it's cross-legged or squatting on a cushion or a chair, so that you feel grounded and you can sit quite still without needing to wiggle around or move very much. The stilling of the physical body will help a great deal in the quieting of the mind. If you're sitting cross-legged,
you might want to experiment making sure that you get up high enough, get your rear end up high enough off the floor that your knees can be down and stable. And if you don't have enough cushions this evening at home as you play with it, you can experiment with different heights to find a way to sit comfortably. So find a way to sit that is stable and comfortable. And then allow your back to be relatively straight, not in a rigid way, but straight enough so your breath can be open and easy. And so the energy can move through you. Also, you'll find if you slump that there's a great tendency to go to sleep or dream off. And sleep is wonderful. But it's different than meditation. And if you're going to do it, I recommend lying down. That's the very best way to do that. All right, so we'll work with this first simple and really universal exercise. Hindu and Christian and Sufi, Islamic, Jewish traditions, as well as Buddhists, work with the breath. So we'll start with the breath. Allow your eyes to close gently. And first of all, just bring your awareness into the present. Notice what you discover. Feel what the body is like. Is there sensations or tension? Is it relaxed? Be aware of the sounds around you or these words. Notice the movements of the heart or the mind. Feelings that are present, thoughts, expectations. This is the stuff of your life, sensations, feelings, thoughts. Now, in the midst of that, become aware of the fact that you are breathing. Or more accurately, that breathing is happening. And for this first meditation, we'll use the movement of breath to begin to train awareness to be in the present. Feel in the midst of all these other things, sense or feel how you experience the breath. Coolness in the back of the throat or in the nose, tingling, movement of the chest, rise and fall of the belly. Try to feel the breath without directing or changing it. Simply become aware. The breath breathes itself. It's our life breath. And for these 10 or 20 minutes, feel each breath as it comes in and out, wherever it shows itself. Sometimes the nose or the belly, maybe sometimes the whole breath. As you feel the breath, try not to control it, but let it find its own rhythms, whatever it wants. you'll notice that the mind wanders off. Each time you're aware that you've gone into thinking or planning or remembering, as soon as you notice, let go of that place and come back here to feel the next breath. Over and over, when you drift away, return back and feel the very next in-breath or the next out-breath. If it helps, you can say to yourself in the background, softly in the mind, in during the in-breath and out during the out-breath. But let those words be 5%. 95% of your attention is to just feel this life breath, the breath that we all share that keeps us alive, as it moves in and moves out. Softening into it, relaxing, feeling the breath wherever you notice it. Each time you've wandered away, come back again when you notice, feeling the next breath, the coolness, the movement, letting the awareness rest on the breath, gently feeling it in the body. One more minute. See if you can feel every breath for 1 minute. Let's just check in for a second. This very basic exercise. How did that go? Anyone?
Sleepy.
Sleepy? Probably a lot of people sleepy. Other things?
I just found feeling physically so uncomfortable.
Yeah. So discomfort from not having a comfortable place to sit. You'd probably be better in a chair or with cushions.
I became very aware of tension.
Tension. Anybody else notice tension in their body? We'll get to that next week. That's a very big topic in meditation.
Mine was a little strange because I felt calm and relaxed, but there was sort of a inner core of, I'm tight here, aren't I? Something, and it wasn't quite tension. It was just, there must be something here that's recorded together.
So some relaxation and then some doubting or worrying or wondering. How many people mind stayed mostly on their breath? Well, that looks like the vast majority didn't. Where did it go? Issues?
Figuring out how old you were.
Figure out how old I am. Forty-three and a half. By some reckoning. Where else did it go, please?
Sounds. Every time the heater came on, I had to pull myself back.
So sounds of the heater. Did it go to plans and expectations and memories? There was a cartoon in the paper some time ago. It shows the guy walking down the street with that usual sign, Jesus is coming. And then a little happy, smiling man behind him with a sign that says, Buddha here now. Now, I actually think that Jesus is here now, too, so it's not. But we have in our culture and in our lives more the idea that what's good is going to come rather than actually coming to rest to be in what is here. Our culture keeps us busy all of the time. So you first started to work with the breath, and a lot of you saw the mind wander quite a bit. It's the first insight. This is called insight meditation. And the very first insight is called seeing the waterfall, which means you tell your mind, stay on the breath, please. Does it listen?
No.
Hardly a prayer. Come on, just do this little thing, stay on the breath. And it plans, and it tells someone else to come and meditate with you, and it, you know, talks about the class, and it balances your checkbook and pays your taxes, and solves old family problems, and then you bring it back to the breath for 3 breaths, and then goes and does something else. What you see is this movement, the constant inner movement or dialogue, that's there all the time, but that we're not so aware of. Now, how can one train the mind in the midst of that? And that's really what meditation is. It's a training of the mind and of the whole power of awareness. I'll give you an image that might be helpful, because we'll do the breath again later this evening. Training to work with the breath is a bit like training a puppy. You pick the puppy up and you put it on a piece of paper, sit it down, stay. Does it stay? Like the mind, not much chance. It gets up, it runs around, pick it up, you put it on the paper again. Stay. over enough times backstay, after a while the puppy starts to figure it out. Well, we're slower than puppies in that regard, but it's possible. When the puppy gets up, it runs around, maybe it pees over in the corner. The mind does much worse things than that. That's nothing. So you clean up the mess the mind makes or whatever, bring it back. Back to the breath. It's the very returning of the puppy to the paper. It's actually the coming back when you notice that you're away, gathering your attention and saying, all right, again, I'm going to be here, bringing the body and mind together in this moment. Over and over, that starts to train you. Now, one other thing that the image is helpful for, if anyone has ever trained a puppy, is it a great idea to beat the puppy? Similarly for yourself, you might see judgmental thoughts come, I can't do it and this isn't working right, and find the mind's habit of judging and beating oneself. It doesn't help at all. You just pick the puppy up gently, back to the next breath. Stay, please stay. Try it again for a couple breaths. That's all. It's that simple. And gradually you begin to connect with the breath. Did anyone have trouble with the breath being awkward where they couldn't relax with it? Was that so for anyone? Did it feel tight or forced? Yes? At the beginning? Yes? Uh-huh. Please.
I found that every time I would try to push myself to concentrate on the breath, then it would just feel awkward. But when I would just kind of let go, I kind of automatically focused on that.
Lovely. So when she pushed to do it, it felt awkward. And this is something new that you're doing for many of you, so in any case it will feel awkward for a while. But if you push or struggle, it makes it more so. And there's a kind of art to meditation which you can learn over some time, which is more graceful, like dancing or music or whatever, where instead of pushing, it's more feeling the rhythm of the breath and letting your body and mind come to rest in that breath rhythm. It'll take some practice, but it can come. You may find tightness also because there's this habit in us of controlling things, and it's hard to watch the breath and not control it a bit. If you notice that, just relax as best you can. And even if there's a little control there, it won't hurt. Gradually, it will diminish. Okay, what I'd like to do at this point is to give you an overview of the teachings or the framework within which this meditation is held or presented traditionally. And this is a teaching which the Buddha called the Eightfold Path. Eight basic steps. The first step of the Eightfold Path, and these are all understandings or ways of looking at meditation in life that perhaps can help you as you develop a meditation practice to fit it in context. The first step of the Eightfold Path is called right understanding. And right understanding has a couple of meanings to it, or true understanding. The first, if one wishes to enter a spiritual life, first aspect of true understanding is that there is suffering in life. Not to be gloomy or anything like that, but that's the place the Buddha decided to start rather than talking about love and peace and happiness. He said, all right, let's start with the basics. There is suffering in life of all kinds. There is the suffering because there are 45 revolutions and wars still on this earth right now, or there have been 115 of them since World War II, and there are only 160 countries, because there are people who are hungry today in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the impoverished parts of our own country, and then there are grain elevators full of food someplace else. There's suffering because people we love die. There's suffering because we don't get what we want all the time. There's our own fears and insecurity and obsessions. depression. Anybody in this room have a life that's pleasure without pain or joy without suffering? Please raise your hand. I'd like to meet you. You're also dismissed. If we want to open our hearts and our minds with awareness, this is the ground that the Buddha started with and which spiritual practice requires, that we have to be willing to look at life quite directly in both sides of it, what are called the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And there is suffering. It's not very, one doesn't have to go very far to see it. Now, in addition to that, in right understanding, there comes with that suffering a sense that things need not be quite the way they are. Much of the suffering of this world is caused by us. Our fight with things because we don't want them to be the way they are, our fears, our greed, our hatred, our prejudice. So there are grain elevators full of food here and starving people there. It's not that there's more food that's necessary, but less greed and less prejudice and less fear and less hatred. So worldwide, the source of war and famine and so forth, to a great extent, is the human heart and mind. And personally, it's the same. Much of the suffering that we experience in our